This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, my name is Andy Boyd, and this is New Books in Performing Arts. My guest on today's program is Sarah Lampert, author of the book Starring Women, Celebrity, Patriarchy, and American Theater, 1790 to 1850. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Could you tell us a little bit about kind of what led you to theater studies?
Yeah. So I am a trained historian who started thinking about popular entertainment in college, actually, when I took a course on actually the history of freakery with my American studies professor, historian Ann Fabian. And we read this book by historian Robert Allen called Horrible Prettiness. And it's about the origins of burlesque. I don't know if you're familiar with it or your listeners are familiar with it, but one of the things that the book made me realize that has really shaped the work I do is that the way that we think about entertainment, how we decide what's tasteful, what's not tasteful, what is worth watching and enjoying, what's dangerous, is often attached to our ideas about who the performers are and who's in the audience. And so there's a lot about the social world of theater and other entertainments that's really important. And those are historical issues.
Mm-hmm. And how did that insight lead to your own research?
Well, I started asking questions that in college I sort of didn't realize you could ask as a historian about, the history of opera singers, right? So folks who come to the academy interested in the history of the performing arts might find what I'm saying a little bit strange, right? But the idea that we might study entertainers and study theater, do what we call sort of cultural history, was really exciting for me. It's not something I had encountered before. And so I started to take those questions to graduate school. And I realized that some of the things I was really interested in about women's publicity, the history of women in public life, and our ideas about changing realms of opportunity for women, I could actually think about those questions in new ways by looking at the history of theater performers.
Great. Could you give us a sense of what it meant to be a celebrity in 1790?
Well, I think it really depends upon where you are. So
Let's say in America, like if you're an American actress, I don't know, maybe you live in New York or something around the turn of that century. What's life like for you? How do you earn your living? What's your kind of social milieu?
Yes, thanks for that clarification. So one of the early stars who I write about, Anne Bruton Mary, I don't know if we could actually call her a celebrity, but she was one of the most celebrated stock actresses in what was in the U.S., a pretty small theater market. There, she acted out of Philadelphia. She was married to another actor. Early in her career, she started being hired to perform a little bit in New York because she was so popular. But for the most part, at that period, right, there wasn't actually much incentive for her to tour. She was really successful in Philadelphia. She made a really, really good wage. And the life of an actor or an actress in this period involved really intense daily study and rehearsal because your repertoire would change every single night. And then you'd perform in the evenings. The seasons would run from you'd have a sort of fall season and you'd have a spring season. And then you'd have a summer where you didn't have any employment. And so the money you earned during that regular theatrical season would have to cover your expenses for the summer, unless you could get some summer engagements. But that type of life is going to change a little bit further into the 19th century when we start to get an expansion of newer theaters being built in the U.S., more access to touring markets. And what starts to happen, particularly in the 1820s, is you start to get some actresses and actors who are making a living as itinerants. And they are making really large amounts of money compared to stock performers. But it's also a pretty intense life because you may be booked in a theater in a particular city for a period of time and then have to travel, traveling long distances, particularly in the early U.S. It's pretty rough. You're traveling in stagecoach on dirt roads. You may be traveling in pretty cramped steamer or early rail. The places where you would stay are not necessarily clean by any modern standards, certainly. But some of these itinerants really complained about the conditions they encountered. It was a really exhausting and intense labor, but you could earn a lot of money.
Yeah, and you kind of write about this making the situation of actresses specifically a kind of ambiguous role, where on the one hand, they're earning much more money than most women at the time, but on the other hand, they do have this very grueling schedule. And you also argue that they had very limited kind of autonomy or maybe agency, if we can use that word. Would you say that's an accurate kind of summary of one of your main arguments?
Yes. And that's actually something I really grapple with throughout researching the book and writing the book and thinking about these women's lives. And I sort of want to kind of call back to your question about celebrity, because the people I chose to write about in this book were, for the most part, the most well-known, the most highly paid, the most sort of visible women entertainers in this period, during a period that saw a lot of changes in the structure of entertainment in America, that was sort of part of these larger transatlantic changes. And so what it meant to be a star actress in 1790 looks really different than in 1850. But one of the assumptions that a lot of folks, including me, had when I was researching this early project is that the more famous you were, if you were an itinerant, right, if you were a touring star, if your name, your likeness, right, is being reproduced and you're being written about, right, that might make you able to be more autonomous, to challenge some of the strictures, the gender strictures of your lives. And as I dug into some of these women's biographies a little bit more, I began to question that assumption because of two things that really came out from the research. One was that for the vast majority of women in theater in this period, they're trained and their career trajectory is really shaped by their parents and by the interests of their families. And there's a lot of pressure on women to marry, both cultural pressure, also industry pressure. And in part, marriage is a way of sort of signifying your conformity to sort of respectable domestic roles for women in a culture in which that is incredibly important and becomes increasingly important as actresses in the early 19th century, particularly star actresses, are trying to convince their publics that they are reputable, respectable women. So that's the sort of second piece of it, is that a big part of being very well known and celebrated is really having to be careful about your public image.
It almost reminded me of like Britney Spears, right? That she's this, you know, incredibly famous, well-known, one of the most well-known people in the world, and yet her life is completely controlled at this point. Well, I don't know what the latest legal developments are, but until recently, she was pretty much completely controlled by her father. Would that have been kind of the norm for, you know, the Britney Spears of the 19th century?
Yes, I mean, and that connection is one that I've thought a lot about. I actually wrote a small piece on that recently. There's a lot that's changed, right, between the 1990s, early 21st century, and the period I'm writing about. But it is absolutely true that in the 18th and 19th century, the theater was a family business. Parents trained their children. And they had an expectation, like parents in many, many other types of work, to control and benefit from their children's labor. And when you had young women, girls and women who were particularly popular, right, this is the case with Clara Fisher, with Fanny Kemble, two women whom I write about, their parents really shaped and encouraged their starring, and in some cases in ways that we find these girls and women didn't really want. And there was a lot of barriers to challenging that control. One of the reasons is that, you know, in an industry in which is so built around family and these professional networks are also tied to family, right? The implications of a woman sort of trying to break away from her parents' control could affect her ability to be hired, to be respected, right? And there are a lot of calculations that they had to make, which is not to say that there weren't women who broke away from parental control but in some cases it was through marrying a guy who may or may not have been the partner who would support these women's visions of their careers.
Mm-hmm. You cover a pretty wide time span in your book from 1790 to 1850. What kind of changes do we see over that time? Does the kind of gendered boundaries of women's lives in this certain, you know, performing arts milieu, does it expand? Does it contract? Is that too simplistic a way to think about it?
I think that it expands in some key ways. So the book ends with a trio of women who all became star actresses who were celebrated as American stars. That's Josephine Clifton, Charlotte Cushman, and Matilda Herron. And one of the things that is super interesting about each of these women, and they sort of rose to renown between the 1830s and the 1850s. None of them came from theatrical families. They pursued stage careers from varying motivations in which a degree of kind of economic pressure may have led them into this, the desire to express themselves through a stage career, but they sought training. And for the most part, Matilda Herron did marry, but for the most part, all of them at the height of their careers were unmarried women who traveled independently, who were really contracting for themselves, and in some cases were caught up in scandals, right? They were always kind of on the edges of respectability and vulnerable to vicious attacks from journalists. But that type of autonomy and that type of trajectory for a girl with no family associations in the theater to becoming a star would not have been as possible in an earlier period. Mm. The structure of theater, the business is changing a little bit. There's a shift away from relying almost entirely on families, on hiring families for stock companies. Now, this increases, in some cases, the ability, sort of power of the manager, right, to sort of contract with individual performers. Maybe it sort of diminishes their bargaining power, right? There are kind of arguments we can make about that shift. But I think there are some opportunities for women. There were some opportunities for women in that shift. And the other thing is, I believe from this research that the expansion of starring and of sort of itinerant starring was beneficial for women because it made it possible for them to leave and to leave particular markets and to go on the road and to increase their earning potential. And that could be incredibly, incredibly liberating.
I got the sense from your book that going to see a play in, say, 1830 might have felt more like going to a play, you know, in 1605 than going to a play today. It seems like a very kind of raucous environment. I mean, you mentioned there were sort of periodic riots that would break out, you know, famously the Astor Place riots, but that was only one of many. I don't think that's really in the cards for a contemporary Broadway audience as much as I sometimes wish it was. So what changes to kind of make theater this kind of more sedate, respectable form of entertainment that you see in like an Edith Wharton novel rather than this, you know, raucous, often literally riotous night out?
It has to do with a shift in terms of who theater is imagined to be for, who the publics are for theater, and changing ideas about public space. And these changes are occurring in England as well as in the United States, though I focus on the US in this book. But theater, 18th century, early 19th century theater is conceived of as a public space with all ranks of society come together. And they each sort of, there's a sort of physical mapping of this in terms of the structure, the interior design of theaters. And that creates a really robust and interactive audience culture. Something that we take for granted today is that when you go to the theater, the lights go down, right? So your focus is automatically drawn to the stage. That wasn't the case until mid 19th century. And so when you go to the theater, you're interacting with the people you're with. You're also watching the performers. You may be completely ignoring the performers, right? In terms of whatever social interaction you're involved with. And there's this, it's a really, the term we use is, it's a culture of audience sovereignty, right? Where the audience is really shaping and controlling the space in a way that could be really dangerous, right? Audiences would have called for performers to perform a soliloquy again or a song again, right? Or they could pelt someone who they felt was offensive either on stage or in their behavior off stage. What starts to change is that managers in the 1830s and 40s in particular start to become interested in recruiting a more, what we would call sort of middle class, respectable audience. The status of theater in the United States is really fraught and contested because there is a really strong anti-theatrical element to American culture. And managers are really concerned about their ability to maintain a profitable business when you've got potentially riotous, lower class audiences who are intermingling in the space with more genteel or elite audiences. And they try really hard to redesign the interior of theaters to make them more appealing to this expanding middle class. And in the process, through some changes to space and changes to the address of who theater is for, it leads to what scholars have called the disciplining of theater audiences. And we also start to see more segmentation of the theater market, where you start to see venues that are more clearly marketed to particular social demographics. And that becomes more and more common by mid-century.
One of the things that I thought was interesting about your book was the extent to which a lot of the women you write about are not American, at least in the early part of the book. You write about performers from England, from Europe, who kind of tour in America and become celebrities in America. Could you talk a bit about the kind of process by which American theater became American in a distinctive way? I mean, it seems like, in sort of 1790, it's still pretty dependent on British models. Is that true?
Oh, absolutely. And continues to be well through mid-century. This is something that often surprises people, right? How much American culture in this period is incredibly shaped by British cultural imports, right? So, and this is also one of the things that makes theater a little bit volatile. So most of the standards of acting are measured on British models. The first theater companies, and I'm talking here about largely Anglophone theater, mostly in the Northeast. There is some Francophone theater in New Orleans that has been part of a sort of growing area of research by some other scholars, but in the Northeastern region, most of the theaters are largely populated by stock companies of British immigrants who came to the U.S. in the late 18th century, early 19th century, and managers are constantly trying to recruit both stock performers and stars from British theater. American periodicals are reprinting reviews and accounts of plays from what's going on in London, right? So if you are reading about arts and literature in the U.S. in the early 19th century, you know a lot about what's going on in London, and you care a lot about it, and you want to see some of those performers. And so that's why there's this demand for British stars. And it actually makes it pretty hard for American-born actresses to move beyond the stock companies and to get a bit more of a kind of broader cultural purchase because they don't have that British pedigree.
You mentioned that standards of acting were kind of modeled on British ideas. What was considered good acting at the time?
So I'll give you an example by talking a little bit about Fanny Kemble and Josephine Clifton. So Fanny Kemble was this English actress, really, really popular, who comes to tour the U.S. in 1832. And she, her father, Charles Kemble, their family lineage goes back to 18th century British theater. And her father, his style of acting was what historians of theater have called a more neoclassical style. His acting really emphasized the sort of elegantly presenting a speech in a way that really conveyed the poetry of the verse. His daughter was a little bit more potentially influenced by a rival style of acting, often called a more romantic style of acting, that emphasized really strong emotional bursts, using sort of starting and stopping and trying to sort of build up intensity, extremes of outburst and quietness to try and capture the sort of emotional arc of a passage and generate a strong, effective response in the audience. And you'll read in a lot of reviews of acting, different ideas about whether an actor or actress was too over the top, or maybe wasn't exciting and dynamic enough. But the idea, the goal of acting in this period, in sort of my understanding, was really to generate this strong emotional response from your audience. And it was not necessarily through what today we would consider naturalism, but actually, I think by our standards, acting in the 19th century would seem really overdone and really exaggerated.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
Both the neoclassical and the romantic style, you think, would seem, yeah.
Yes, I think so.
Is it frustrating as a historian writing about the live event of theater and kind of not knowing when a reviewer says, oh, this person was way over the top, like what that actually meant, like what that actually would have looked like? Or do you feel like you're able to kind of piece together from the sources a pretty good sense of how Fanny Kemble would have appeared on a stage?
It's frustrating. It requires a lot of imagination. And yeah. And one of the things that I thought a lot about in writing this, so reviewers writing about entertainers in this period had a lot of their kind of own their own axe to grind, for lack of a more elegant phrasing. So to sort of go back to where we started the conversation, a lot of the journalists reviewing theater were really, like, the reason why they were doing this was because they really wanted certain types of entertainments to be performed, right? They were really, they wanted theater to be, as they would put it, like, uplifted. They wanted there to be more of what they called the legitimate drama or sort of high drama. And they didn't like the fact that there were a lot of forms of entertainment, like sort of pantomimes and low comedy, that were really, really popular with audiences, or types of drama that they didn't find particularly sophisticated, or styles of acting that they found a little bit lacking and not genteel. And so whenever you read these reviews, you always got to kind of ask yourself, like, what does this writer want theater to be, mm-hmm. right? And how might that be shaping the way they're reading this performer? So there's always these levels of mediation. And so then it sort of goes back to, right, what are some of the ways in which, what are some of the larger patterns of what's seen as bad? Why is it seen as bad? Instead of automatically taking at face value the idea that someone's acting may be bad, if I'm making
sure. I mean, I think that's certainly something that we encounter today, that I think every theater person knows, like, what are the, you know, kind of weird biases and prejudices that different, you know, prominent theater critics have today, and that they kind of read through that lens when we read reviews by those people.
Oh, absolutely. One of the things that I think I find a little bit frustrating in some of the older scholarship that I was engaged with is some of that, I found that some of that scholarship was more likely to take these texts at face value in ways that I didn't necessarily think they could be or they should be.
Mm-hmm. Could you talk a bit about how these women kind of navigated their public performance, or maybe their public persona is a better way to put it, being as much in the spotlight as their theatrical performance?
Yeah. And I'll call back to Kemble, and I promised you that I would talk about Josephine Clifton. So I'll talk about them together, because I think they're a really interesting pairing. So Kemble comes over in 1832. Her father actually arranges for her stage debut in London in 1829 because he's bankrupt from managing in London. And so he is hoping to basically make a lot of money from her. And we know from her letters and her journal, which later is edited and published, that she's not really crazy about this. We also know that her father was very, very instrumental in trying to shape her reputation. She was very interested in writing. She really wanted to be a writer. She does become a writer. But so he wanted her to publish her poetry. He invited journalists to meet with them. She complains about this in her journal. He has her portrait painted, right? So in a lot of the sources we have about her, it's her kind of bristling at the performance expected of her as a public figure. And while there are things that she really liked about acting, she really hated her publicity, the sort of this way in which being an actress forced her into the public eye, brought aspects of her private life into the public eye, and brought scrutiny to bear on her in ways that, like, she makes this offhanded comment at a stable about American horses that gets used against her. It's like published in a broadside that she's like attacking Americans. There's almost a riot in a theater about this, right? And she's just like, she's not happy camper. She is very much a person who doesn't quite want to play the game of celebrity in a moment in which there is a growing media scrutiny of performers. Someone like Josephine Clifton, she doesn't come from an acting family. She comes from poverty. Her mother worked in the sex trade, tries really, really hard to emulate Kemble in certain ways. She tries to play the same roles as her, imitate her style. Actually, Charles Kemble trains Clifton a little bit. But one of the things that keeps dogging Clifton's career is that she's always found lacking compared with Kemble, right? And she doesn't have that London pedigree. And at various points in her career, journalists keep dragging up details about her family background that are used to discredit her. And so at one point she writes this public letter trying to defend her virtue and the virtue of her sister from these attacks. And so she is also somebody who, she doesn't have the luxury of sort of being dismissive of journalists. Kemble is dismissive, and in some cases it backfires, but for the most part, she remains pretty successful. Clifton doesn't have that luxury, and she really fights for what ends up being a really longstanding and successful career, but she's always vulnerable to these types of media attacks.
One of the things that I think might surprise a lot of listeners about your book is how much women often played male roles at this time. I mean, we might know about Sarah Bernhardt playing Hamlet, but that was maybe not as exceptional as we might assume, especially given, you know, what we might assume about rigid Victorian gender roles. Were these performances considered transgressive at the time, or do they only appear that way in retrospect?
Yes and no. Breeches acting was wildly popular with audiences. It was also heavily criticized by some of those dramatic critics who I alluded to earlier, who found it tasteless. But for the most part, American audiences, men and women, went to the theater and enjoyed these performances. But I think what's important to remember is that a lot of the roles in which actresses wore the breeches were roles that involved playing boys or playing girls who dressed up as boys in order to kind of rescue a lover. So there were ways in which they really reinforced ideas about that women are there to kind of help and heal and nurture, or that associated femininity with sort of juvenileness. And there was, of course, I think, the unmistakable kind of sexual allure of seeing a woman in pants, in these pantaloons. And some actresses actually refused to take on these roles. And some actresses were really famous for them, and in some cases pushed certain envelopes in terms of how they portrayed these characters. But what we don't see as much in Breech's acting in this period are actresses taking on and being celebrated in what were considered sort of serious, dramatic male leads. The few actresses who did were really famous for doing so and beloved. Charlotte Cushman is one of the most famous. Ellen Tree is another. But because of the association of Breech's acting with this sort of these more lower forms of drama and with this more sort of sexual appeal, it was not, it was sort of a risky endeavor for an actress who was trying to market herself within a more dramatic line or to take on some of these characters.
Hmm. Could you tell us a bit about how theater touring intersected with Westward expansion, especially by kind of mid-century?
So one of the things that starts to happen over the 1820s and 30s is managers start opening theaters in regions of the U.S. that are being where you basically are establishing sort of an American settler presence, and they're trying to. So I think that theater in the 1820s and 30s very much is part of a whole number of institutions that are trying to establish the United States dominance and culture west of the Mississippi. And this has a very practical benefit to performers in extending the potential reach of their touring, right? So it's in the earlier period, we might in arrange tours between New York, Boston, Philadelphia, some Southern theaters. But for the most part, there are primarily these Eastern markets. And all of a sudden, by the 20s and 30s, there is access to theaters in Cincinnati, St. Louis. Managers are opening theaters sort of along the Ohio River and the Mississippi River. And this sort of expands potential touring. There's also sort of, so a performer can go out and do an engagement in Cincinnati and then tour within the region in smaller venues. And so your ability to make a living on the road increases markedly. And it creates, on the one hand, right, the ability for European, both English and then continental European stars to extend the length of their tours and potentially increase their earning potential. But it also creates an opportunity for sort of a secondary level of performers, sort of lower tier performers, to start to develop regional reputations. And people like, you have some people like Elizabeth Hamblin, who actually is, she divorces her husband, Thomas Hamblin, who's just like a totally horrifying human being. Part of their divorce is that she can't act in New York anymore. So she goes on the road. And her ability to do that is made possible by these Western markets.
Could you tell us a bit about Fanny Elsler? I guess one of my questions is like, what did it mean to be a dancer in the 19th century? And what were people, why were people going to go see her when they went to see one of her performances?
So Fanny Elsler was one of the most celebrated dancers of Europe at the time when she comes to the U.S. She was part of a very different entertainment culture in continental Europe, where you have basically sort of state-supported operas and ballets that really nurtured and supported these careers. And she has a rises to prominence at the Paris Opera. She performs in London, and she is just wildly, wildly celebrated in Europe. Managers in America want her to come to the U.S. She's not convinced that American audiences are really going to appreciate her, that she's really going to make what's worth the travel. Finally, one guy convinces her, and she comes in 1840. Now, Americans have been exposed to European ballet at this point. It was not as scandalous as it had been when it is introduced in the 1820s. And so they have some sense of the conventions of ballet and the types of performance. But they're also, one of the things that is incredible about Elsler, so she along with one of her rivals, Marie Taglioni, introduced some changes in ballet where dancers would spin higher up on their toes, basically, not full point like what we expect today, where you have like a blocked shoe, but really high up on their toes. And audiences were just like amazed by this and amazed by her spins. And this is really, it's incredibly athletic and dynamic in ways that they found very exciting, but also a little bit scandalous. Now, part of the performances that Elsler gives in the U.S. were ballets that we often refer to as the romantic ballets, like La Sylphide, that told stories about fairies. And so you have these dancers performing characters that are not human women in ways that some scholars who I draw on have argued kind of managed the sort of the aspects of the performance that may have potentially crossed lines of acceptable display of women's bodies. And there was definitely an eroticism in terms of these spinning dancers with their skirts going up. But audiences were also just absolutely blown away by how much these dancers seemed to carry the music through their movement in ways that the audience could read the music in the dancers' movement and described it as a poetry of motion. Elsler was met by huge crowds anxious to see her, let alone see her performance. And she, I mean, was met with this wild fascination. And the way people described her performances were, there was clearly something different in terms of her technique, her expressiveness, but also her that fascinated Americans.
Great. Well, Sarah, it's been such a pleasure to talk with you about your book, Starring Women. Could you give our listeners a sense of what your next project might be?
One of the things that I have always wanted to delve into a little bit more are women managers. And there's been some phenomenal research about women managers in London in the 19th century. And some of that work has been really influential to me in this project. And there's a cohort of women managers in the 1850s, in fact, who I think are due a little bit more study and a little bit more investigation of how they were able to sort of achieve these types of positions and in such a male-dominated industry in this moment and what it tells us about shifting realms of opportunity for women in 19th century theater.
Well, I'll certainly be on the lookout for that. Sarah Lampert, thanks so much for being on New Books in Performing Arts to talk about Starring Women. It was a real pleasure to get to talk with you about it.
Yeah, and thanks so much for taking the time to read the book and to ask such wonderful questions. I really enjoyed this. Thanks for the opportunity.